Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to this session of the Roundtable. A few people were asking me about the WCNY podcast. As you know, our program is taped by WCNY FM. They broadcast it on Sunday evening, and then sometime after Sunday evening, they post it on the WCNY website. There's a link to Thursday Morning Roundtable, and there's no set time, so it's when they have a chance to do it. So if you get a chance, if, for instance, you missed Superintendent Contreras last week or you want to hear it again, check back. It should be on the website. And then the nice thing is they do keep them up for a while, so you can go back and see some of the other programs. So, again, this program should be on this Sunday night, coming Sunday night at 8 p.m., and then during that week sometime, podcast, just to let you know. Okay, heads up again, next week, Greg Tripoli from the OHA, Pam Hyland from Girl Scout Council. You know it's going to be, a lot of you may not know Pam. She's relatively new to us, and I don't see her here at the minute to point her out, but you've heard Greg speak before, so you know it's going to be interesting, entertaining. He says it's keeping him up nights. It's so interesting and fascinating, the whole 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts and all of that. Into November, I'll give you a heads up. Again, beginning of November, Jason Helgerson, the New York State Medicaid director, probably after public pensions or maybe even before, on top of everything, Medicaid, as we know, we've heard many times from the county executive, current and past, about the growth in Medicaid costs. Jason Helgerson is the new state Medicaid director, going to talk about the Medicaid redesign restructuring. The week after that, one of our annual favorites, the Ivory Tower Hour, is going to be here. So that's that. But right now, I want to thank Mayor Miner for being here to introduce today's guest speaker. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We really are fortunate this morning to be joined by Mr. McMahon. And by way of introducing him, I'd like to talk to you about something that happened in December of 2010 on a very popular television show, 60 Minutes. On that show, Meredith Whitney talked about the fact that the next financial crisis about to hit the United States would be a crisis in governments. And for those of you who don't remember, Meredith Whitney was one of the first Wall Street analysts who predicted the mammoth subprime losses that led to an incredible economic collapse. And what Ms. Whitney said in doing some research was that she found that, indeed, U.S. and local governments face a collective annual debt of roughly $500 billion, plus another $1 trillion gap between what governments owe retired workers and the money on hand to pay them. And when they asked Whitney about what this would mean for state governments, she shook her head and she said, you know, I wouldn't worry about state governments defaulting, because what state governments can do is they can just push all their responsibilities down to cities and counties. And she said, in the next 12 months, you are going to start to see huge bankruptcies across major cities in the United States. And sure enough, recently we have started to see that happen. Cities like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Central Falls, Rhode Island, Vallejo, California, and others. And our guest this morning, this is no news to him. He did not need to watch 60 Minutes in December of 2010 to know about this. And in fact, he has been thinking, writing, and finally warning about these issues for the majority of his professional career. Mr. McMahon is currently a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and its Albany-based Empire Center for New York State Policy. His recent work has included studies focused on New York State's unsustainable public pensions and retiree health care costs, the outmigration of New York workers. He is a frequent contributor to the New York Post, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and many other magazines. So would you please join me in welcoming E.J. McMahon.
Well, thank you very much. Whenever I do, raise the microphone. Thank you very much. Can I be heard? I'm loud. Some say too loud anyway, so I think I can manage, even if the microphone goes out. Whenever I do events like this, I'm reminded of a breakfast much like this one a few years ago that I attended, and I was sitting next to a colleague of mine from the Manhattan Institute who's based in Boston, so I don't see him that much. And we were trading, updating each other on what we're doing lately, and he said, well, what's the next big thing on your horizon? And I said, well, actually, the public pension issue, the crisis is really heating up, and I expect to be doing a lot of work in that area in the next few years. And he said, well, I wish you luck because, you know, my wife always says the words unfunded pension liability are the three most boring words in the English language. Now, I have to agree, I have to acknowledge that that's probably correct. My role here today is to demystify this topic a bit. I can't promise that it'll be titillating and amusing. It may leave you with a few financial nightmares, which is stimulating in a different way. I think to begin with, I should be on the hook to defend to you my use of the word crisis in describing what's going on with public pensions and indeed with long-term liabilities of different sorts that our state and local governments have. And so I went to my Merriam-Webster's, my handy Merriam-Webster's, and the third definition of crisis is an unstable or crucial time or state of affairs in which a decisive change is pending, especially one with a distinct possibility of a highly undesirable outcome. Well, that fits pretty well. The highly undesirable outcome has begun to unfold, and this is just the beginning. So, let me begin, though, by talking about a few basics of pension funding. And now, I promise you, despite the early slides, this is not one of those slide presentations where words appear on the screen that merely replicate what I say. There won't be a quiz afterwards, and the slideshow will be posted on one of our websites, and I will make and you will be able to get copies of it. I think we can work it out through Sandra Barrett here. It'll be on your website, so you'll be able to get it, so you can just listen and be enthralled and not have to take notes. But let's go through a few of the basics. Let's start with what public pension systems are in New York, and then we'll talk about how they're funded. There are three major pools of public pension retirement money in New York State. The New York State and local retirement system, to which all state employees and all local government employees outside New York City except educators belong, in which they are in fact automatically enrolled. That has 643,000 active member employees, and there are 345,000 pensioners and retirees and beneficiaries in the system. There are in addition, within that system, actually that pool has two groups of people, two different types of employees in it. One is known as the employee retirement system, which is people outside of law enforcement, the majority. And then there's the police and fire retirement system, which is local police and fire and state police, which has 35,000 active members and 30,000 pensioners and beneficiaries. In fact, we're reaching the tipping point where there will be more retirees and actives in the police and fire system. We also have the New York State Teachers Retirement System, which, as the name indicates, is all professional educators working in public sector educational institutions in New York State and also in a few other places, not excluding New York City. There are 265,000 or so active members and almost 142,000 pensioners and beneficiaries in that system. So do the math, and we've now come up to basically about 500,000 pensioners and beneficiaries of the statewide systems. And then I'm going to quickly go through these. I'm not going to dwell on these today, but I want you to be aware of them because, as you know, what happens in New York City is of enormous consequence statewide because it's 40% of the state's economy, actually almost 40% of the population, a bigger share of the state's economy. New York City has, unlike all the other localities in the state, has its own pension funds for its own employees, which have five separate types based on category of employment. And their problem and their crisis is, if anything, worse than the state's crisis, which, again, is of concern to you because everything that affects New York City ultimately affects the whole state also. Now, defined benefit pensions 101. What is a defined benefit pension? And I'm sorry if you can't see that, but I'll repeat that. A defined benefit public pension is one that delivers a stream of income based on career duration, age at retirement, final average salary, and occupational category. As I noted, if you're a police or firefighter, you have a different type of pension than someone who's a civilian working in a white-collar job or a non-law enforcement job. So what, again, as its name indicates, the benefit is defined. You retire, depending on how long you work and what you made and what kind of job you had, you have a set income. Comes in month after month, it's sent to you. How do we pay for this? Well, it is financed by investment returns, employer contributions, and, to a certain extent, limited, employee contributions. Money is put into these central pension funds, the ones that I identified at the beginning. And the notion is, ideally, pensions are pre-funded, that before you retire, the money is there to pay your pension. Where it's not pay-as-you-go like Social Security. It's supposed to be all there. Not only is it supposed to be all there when you get there, we're supposed to be putting away enough now on a carefully calibrated actuarial and financial basis to ensure that when you retire, it will be all there. And you, in this case, plural, being hundreds of thousands of employees of different career durations and types. The New York State Constitution is one of four or five in the country that not only treats pensions as contractual, but it said there's a constitutional provision that said the benefits of membership in a public retirement system are contractual in nature and cannot be diminished or impaired. That's interpreted to mean that you cannot change any, not only can you not change a pension benefit for somebody who's already retired, which would really be beyond the pale, you can't do what's done in many corporate plans and what arguably could be done in many other public plans in other states and say that you no longer, you know, close a plan and say that you no longer accrue benefits from this point onwards. We're changing it and it's not going to be what you originally signed up for. These rules mean that what you sign up for is what you're entitled to no matter what, even if the plan is radically changed for people hired after you. Somewhere this morning, as we sit here, somebody is reporting for their first day of work, even though there's hiring freezes, there's people you have to replace, somebody is reporting for their first day of work at a government office within a few miles of here, and that person is entitled for the rest of their lives to, at a minimum, the pension benefit structure that's in place right now. Can't be changed. That's what that means. There's five basic tiers based on hiring rate date, the latest of which was adopted a little over a year ago. I'll get into that. Defined benefit pensions are increasingly rare in the private sector. They used to be common, and here's a note. Even when defined benefit pensions were common in the private sector, they were not as generous as public sector pensions. In the heyday of private sector defined benefit pensions, they were not as generous as public sector pensions. One reason why is that decades ago, New York and most and all other states just about, 50 and 60 years ago, public employees were not in Social Security. Their entire retirement income was supposed to come from their pensions. Today, only 25% of public sector employees in the country and a smaller number of jurisdictions have their employees not in Social Security. But the residual of that, the legacy of that, is that public sector benefits tend to be very generous because they were originally designed to be the whole benefit. It was 45 or 50 years ago that New York State public employees and those in many other states began going into Social Security and in fact get both. Most private sector employees have what are known as defined contribution plans, the 401k being an example, in which the employer puts in money, the employee puts in money, and what's available at retirement is based on how much is saved over the worker's career. Employee contributions in a defined benefit pension are fixed or capped at low levels of salary, if not zero, depending on the employee, when he or she was hired, and what plan they're in. Last but not least, employee contributions fluctuate and can fluctuate quite widely as a percentage of payroll. Taxpayers shoulder the full upside and downside risks of the performance of the investment funds. How are those pension funds invested? Well, 35 years ago, they were invested like life insurance funds are required to be invested by the state insurance regulators. They were very conservative. They were heavily into low-risk investment, bonds, money market accounts. I mean, it was very low risk profile. Why? Because the benefit is zero risk to the recipient. It's a no-risk benefit, and therefore the money was invested on a no-risk basis. During the previous version of the pension crisis, around 1980, when all the public pension funds in the country realized they were going broke, although their accounting was less advanced than it is now, they began investing in a big way in the stock market. They used to only have about 20% of their money in the stock market. They began investing in a big way in the stock market, and as luck would have it, they started investing in the stock market on the cusp of the greatest stock market boom in modern history. Thus, they were able to manipulate their funding parameters in a way that made everything look swell and cheap for basically the last generation. Now, I should point out that this issue of the variability of the employer contribution, the employer, by the way, is you. Whether or not you even worked in government at any point, the employer is the taxpayers. The fluctuation of the employer contribution, the unpredictability of where it's going to be, the open-ended compounded financial risk imposed on taxpayers by this system of guaranteeing a no-risk benefit for people. All of this is not like in computerese, this is not a bug, this is a feature. This is what comes with a defined benefit plan. It's not a bug, it's a feature. So, what's a public pension worth, by the way? Let me digress a little bit. We have a calculator on one of our websites, www.nypensionbomb.com, and again, you'll have a reminder of this address if you want to go on this website. You can plug in a target retirement age and years of experience for an employee in one of the different New York State systems and see what's their pension, and what would you have to have in the bank in the private sector to replicate that income. So here's somebody who's a teacher who's worked for 37 years, wants to retire at the age of 59, which actually is typical. Teachers actually retired at an average age of 57 or 58 in New York State. And has a final average salary of $95,000, which is pretty much close to the norm in most large suburban districts. It's actually downstate, the norm now is about $120,000 for a teacher. So you retire with a final average salary of $95,000, after 37 years in your late 50s, you're entitled to a pension of $66,000 a year. Now, what would you have in your retirement account to buy an annuity that would pay you $66,000 a year? You would have to have $1.3 million. That's the value of a public pension. Now, this has been no secret. We wrote a report back in 2003 pointing out that this system, which contributed to a previous budgetary meltdown in the Empire State, will remain a ticking fiscal time bomb if it remains unchanged. Oops, pardon me. It's a narrow podium. Well, much as I hate to say I told you so, the bomb is going off. It's not rocket science to have predicted this, by the way. And affirmed, in fact, by no less than the governor, who used the same phrase in his State of the State message a few months ago, pension costs of pensions are exploding. Yes. Now, I should make another point here before I get into how far they're exploding. I talked about the finances of pensions. Let me mention one important issue here. Public sector pension plans use different accounting rules than private sector pension plans. This is what the Government Accounting Standard Board imposes on them. This is a huge, huge controversy among professional actuaries and financial economists. All of the financial actuaries and financial economists, without exception, in academia and business, outside public sector pension funds, agree that they're doing it the wrong way. This is not about politics or ideology. They all agree the pension funds are doing it the wrong way. What they do is, when you have any amount of income, any amount of money, and you have to pay a future stream of income to people over 30, 40 years, the crucial factor in determining how much money do I need now is something called the discount rate. That is, how much money will I earn? Let me give you an example. You promise somebody you're going to pay them $250,000 10 years from now. How much money do you need to have now to be assured of having $250,000 in 10 years? Well, let's say you know about a company whose stock has grown by 8% a year, appreciated over the last 30 years. Well, that sounds safe to me. I'll invest it in that stock, and I think it's going to earn 8%. Well, if you think that, if you're confident of that, you need to have $115,000 or so now in order to have $250,000 in 10 years. Now, let's say the guy you promised the $250,000 to is a fellow named Tony Soprano. Tony and his friends, you've given them a promissory note, and you said, I'll have the money, and if I don't give you the money, you can take my house. Now, Tony's attitude is, in 10 years, I want $250,000. I don't want $190,000. I don't want $220,000. I don't want $248,000. I want $250,000. And if you don't give it to me, I'm taking your house. And if you're lucky, I won't break your legs. Now, how do you feel about what kind of investment you make that money? How do you feel? How much money do you think you need to have to feel safe about not losing your house? Well, you'll put it in, say, a AAA-rated corporate bond, which makes 4% a year. How much money do you need to have? You need to have $169,000, which is over $50,000 more. Well, on a big scale, the pension funds undervalue there. They discount their liabilities using what they hope, the rate they hope to earn, which is 8% in most cases. The state fund just went down to 7.75%. Meredith Whitney said that the pension funds have an unfunded liability, to use that boring phrase, of $1 trillion. That's their official estimate. Research by very well-qualified financial analysts and academicians has come up with a number of $2 trillion, actually discounting liabilities the way private sector funds do. So what's the explosion look like? Okay, the city of Syracuse, the mayor, the county, the way they pay for pensions every year is once a year they get a bill from the pension fund, and that bill is calibrated as a percentage of payroll. The police and fire payroll has one percentage. The payroll for everybody else has another percentage. And they say, give us 12% of that, or some number. And the city sends a check in. It's not like deducted every payroll period. It's once a year they send in this check. It's a percentage of payroll. Those lines are the percentage of payroll contributions to the pension funds, to the three different funds that I talked to you about on the state level. Employee retirement system, police and fire retirement system, which together are under the umbrella pension, state pension fund as it's called, and the teachers retirement system. Now note, between the 1980 and 2000, those rates plummeted. Why? Well, what did I tell you? They started investing more heavily in stocks. The stock market exploded. By 2000, they're paying practically nothing. In fact, for much of the 1990s, the ERS contribution rate was very, very low. Now, the normal rate in the imaginary steady state universe where the funds are always fully funded, where the economy never varies, and where the returns each and every year are what you expect, the normal cost of an employee retirement system pensions in the most recent pension tiers was 11%. If you look, for a good decade, they paid well under 11%. Police and fire, the normal cost is like 17%. They were paying less than that. This couldn't last, and it didn't. The rates have sharply increased to make up for investment losses since 2000. This is the headache you're now hearing about. This is what you're now hearing Mayor Minor and the county executive and other local officials complain about. This is what's happening to them now, but it's not over. We calculated where they're going, and we've been accurate in this, and the public pension funds have not actually countered our estimate. This is where they're going. Okay? That's where you are. That's where you're going. So the current contribution level for the ERS is, I think Mayor just went up to 14% or so, something like that. It's going above 20. And that's going to be the highest level, as the chart shows you, in more than 30 years. An entire generation of public officials has been happily hiring and giving raises to people under the misimpression that you could also promise them a very generous pension and early retirement at a cost that's basically peanuts. Well, it's not true. This generation's now getting to pay for that. Now, the pension fund assets, I'll just go through. Remember, the pension funds think they're going to make 8% every year. What actually happened the last 10 years? Well, what basically happened is that during the past decade, it was a lost decade. None of the pension funds made any money in the last 10 years. Now, this includes some of their takeoff for rising benefits because benefits doubled. The benefit outflow doubled, and it's now increasing at a faster pace than that. So the money's going out at a faster and faster rate. It's not coming in at the rate they expect. And the net result of that is they're in the hole. You know the old financial rule? It's if you basically, if you have $100 and you lose 50, which is a 50% loss, how much do you need to gain to make up that loss? 100%. All right, so the fund, when the fund loses 26% 1 year, as it did 3 years ago, then makes 24%, and the comptroller puts out a press release, says, happy days, we made 24%. You lost 26% on a year when you wanted to make 8. They're way down in the hole, way down in the hole. They made 14% last year. Guess how much they're making more than halfway through their current fiscal year? Nothing. That's not because they're incompetent or they haven't invested. You know, I mean, that's basically what the markets are doing. This is what the contributions have been. This is the way we've come. This is another version of that chart. The line is the employee contribution. Under Sweeteners enacted in the late 90s, the employees, senior employees, don't contribute anything. They were contributing 3. That's the teachers. This is the state and local retirement system. That's their contributions. So you can see who's paying for this. Again, this is not a bug. This is a feature. This is the way it works. Now, is there a way to deal with this? What can we do about this? The short answer is nothing. There is nothing you can do about this. The comptroller has come up with a way that's meant to kind of reshape the obligation and spread it out into the future, called rate mitigation. Rate mitigation is depicted by what's happening here. You basically have the pension fund, and what you do is you pay it some cash with IOUs. You cap the contribution rate on an annual basis. The state and local governments can opt into this. You pay them some now, and the rest is turned to a 10-year note, repayable at 5% interest, which, conveniently enough, the pension fund books as an asset. It's a fixed income investment with a 5% interest rate. So it's all good. So that's what's going on. Basically, the billed amount above the cap is amortized over 10 years. Now, when you're in a really extreme pressurized situation, like, for instance, the city of Syracuse is, this is obviously a very tempting option. So the city and some other places that have severe problems have taken it, because otherwise you're immediately looking at literally millions of dollars in pension increases, and there's no place else you can get that money short of, you know, laying off cops or not plowing some streets or something. I mean, that this is, and it's getting more and more significant. But the problem is, if we have a loss, because there's fat tail risks, as they say, we don't know what the future is. Nobody can. If you have like a Japan-style lost decade, or you have another decade where the stock market surges up, you know, 50% and then drops back down to where it is now, you're basically it's just a pile of slush being pushed further down the road. It's not actually, you're basically stretching out the problem, and it will actually, ameliorate the problem now, but it doesn't actually fix it. So we need to understand that we're not fixing it. We're simply just trying to moderate the impact. And I think more and more municipalities will be doing this in the next couple of years because of the stress that's caused by the pension costs. The teacher retirement system has not done this. The legislature tried to sneak in a bill at the very end of session that would have allowed school systems to bond out, to issue bonds for part of their pension obligation. The governor vetoed it. A similar bill was done a decade or more ago for localities, and as of the last fiscal year, the city of Syracuse had $2.5 million. Sorry, I'm used to talking in billions, being in Albany. City of Syracuse had $2.5 million in debt related to old pension obligation bonds. And it's not alone. Almost every city in the state of any size has pension obligation bonds outstanding, in addition to this problem. This is where employer contributions are going. Now, interestingly, that the pale part is the amortization. In other words, if everybody did the amortization, this is what the result would be. So as you can see, basically, you end up being almost as high as you would have been anyway after 5 years. You're just pushing it, you're smoothing it out. And again, it's the least worst way of dealing with the problem, but it's not actually, you can't reduce the cost. There's nothing you can do in the short term. You can only stretch it out. By the way, using the right discount rate, how do the pension funds look? By their own accounting standards, in New York State public, all the state public pension funds on the state level are fully funded. Good news, we're fully funded. We're the best funded funds in the country. Now, by the way, compared to other state funds, they are the best funded funds in the country. They are. Illinois, you want to really have a nightmare. If you live in Illinois, if you have friends in Illinois, tell them to get out fast. It's really, really bad. Jersey is very, very bad. California is not great. We are fully funded by public accounting standards. How are we funded according to real-world private sector standards that everybody in the private sector accounting, actuarial, and financial economics field agrees is the right standard? They are $120 billion short of what they need by private sector standards. They're 65% funded, or 65 to 69% funded. They're not 100% funded. But again, the city, New York City funds are worse, and some other major states are far worse than that, so if that makes you feel good. We need fundamental pension reform. Now, there was something called Tier 5 that Governor Patterson called landmark reform. I won't get into the details because this is where I really will be getting into the three most boring words in the English language, but if you're in one of these systems, you'll understand this. Basically, Tier 5 is basically a reversion to the original Tier 4. This is a problem with reforming a defined benefit pension system by saying we're going to fix it by making it less generous. Remember, this is a long-term thing. Nobody's collecting the benefits for 30 years. Over time, what happens is when you take a defined benefit fund and say we're going to make the benefits less generous, guess what happens? As soon as there's a few years of daylight financially, naturally doing what they're supposed to do, not because they're bad, unions lobby to make them better. The goal of every union in the state on pensions is what's known as tier equity. Tier equity is to make the later tiers as generous as the early tiers. So what happened? Tier 4 became so generous that we needed Tier 5 to restore what Tier 4 had been. That's what Tier 5 is. Now, Governor Cuomo has proposed Tier 6. Tier 6 is radically less generous. It's like Tier 5 squared. It's much less generous. But it's the same basic design, same bug, same feature that I said is not a bug. Basically, it's like taking you have weeds in your yard. You just whack the weeds. Well, what happens is they grow back. So what's not to like about the governor's plan? For instance, he would eliminate overtime spiking by police of pensions. That's probably the most valuable feature of what he has, because there are police all over the state whose pensions are more than their salaries, and firefighters, because of what they do with overtime in their final years, and they get very expensive. Downstate, there's police commonly now who retire with six-figure pensions. There's 140 Nassau County cops with pensions of over $100,000. And Yonkers, places like that. And it's relative to income, it's the same everywhere in the state. That's a good thing. That's a really key feature of his plan. But in general, the problem with his approach is it's not structural reform. You still have the guaranteed defined benefit pension with the open-ended, potentially compounded financial risk for taxpayers. He didn't even step in the direction of offering a defined contribution plan as an option. And as we'll see in a minute, the state of New York, in fact, something that's poorly understood by most people but should be understood well here near a college campus, actually sponsors one of the largest public sector defined contribution plans in the country, and it's a smashing success. What is it? TIAA-CREF. It's been in existence for 45 years. Why couldn't we offer that to school teachers? What's the benefit of TIAA-CREF? You know what every year you make a contribution to that teacher's account, actually you do it per paycheck, and you know what it's going to be, and there is no long-term obligation. None. The phrase long unfunded pension obligation disappears from your vocabulary because it's the teacher's personal account. The benefit for the teacher is it's portable. Is it guaranteed against atomic blasts like our current pension? No. That's the trade-off. However, TIAA-CREF has worked out pretty well for the people who have it. So the fundamental reform goals are we need affordability and predictability for taxpayers, we need to eliminate open-ended long-term liabilities, and we need, last but not least, we need to offer retirement security and flexibility to our employees. Security and flexibility. When I hear the alternative that I'm talked about as a 401k, now that immediately gets people's dander up for good reason. Most 401ks are lousy. They are poorly designed, they're expensive, high fee, and they're drastically underfunded. So the typical private sector 401k, especially in smaller and mid-sized employers, will not offer retirement security and flexibility to workers. That's not what you got to go to. You got to go to something more like the TIAA CREF option. And we need to minimize opportunities for distortions in gaming. This system I've been telling you about is very complicated. Nobody really understands it. It's just an enormous moral hazard, basically, in a phrase economists like to use, meaning a temptation. The temptation is overwhelming for people to game it, to put in benefits that won't be paid for years. It's human nature. It's a disaster. Except for the people who receive the pension. And by the way, I'm a member of a public pension system. I'm barely vested in the New York State system. And what I got from just 6 years is something I would need over $100,000 to replicate. Fundamental reform options. So I just define contribution. I won't go into this in detail. Michigan, all of Michigan state employees, every state employee hired by state of Michigan since 1997. State of Michigan. It's not a one-party conservative rump state by any means. Okay? Since 1997, every single state employee has been in a defined contribution 401k style plan. What half of their employees now are in that plan. What does that mean? They have half the problem. Because half their employees, there is no long-term liability for half their employees. They've got their own accounts. And they've been doing it almost unnoticed since then. As I said, SUNY and CUNY, two of the largest public education systems in the country, have offered this as an option for 45 years. Two-thirds of the professors and others working there choose it. Another option is the hybrid. The federal government offers a hybrid plan. The state of Utah just did a promising hybrid model. That's something we can talk about. We need transparency. True North, the New York City actuary, is a guy named Bob North. Bob North, on his own volition, insists on all his reports with the public pension fund reports down there on showing what their funded status would be using real-world private sector accounting standards. At the very least, our state fund should be doing that. And they should be required by law to do it because, unfortunately, they refuse to do it now. They should be tell us what the statistical likelihood is that they will meet their return targets, which if you actually saw it, you would see is less than 50%. They should post their financial results promptly and in real time on the Internet, which they've begun to take a step towards, but a very slow step from the state fund standpoint. And they need to calculate and publish their projected cash flows. You got several hundred thousand people, they're in a fund, you're saving money for their retirement. Wouldn't you think that I'd be able to ask them, show me what the cash flow is for the next 50 years? What's it look like? You know what the answer is from them and every single public pension fund in the country? No, we don't do it that way. You don't do it that way. No. It's a black box. Could they produce it? Yes. They'd have to push a button. They'd have to walk across the room and push a button, and then you'd have it. You can reverse engineer it, and we actually have done some estimates of it, but they don't publish it. Now, from bombs to icebergs, quickly, there's another problem. Virtually every public employee of every government jurisdiction, local government and school district of any size in New York State also gets retiree health insurance. This is even less common in the private sector than pensions are. Virtually nobody in the private sector gets this anymore. Only the largest companies ever offered it, and they are quickly reducing it. So all of the public employers in the state offer their employees continuing health insurance in the employee health plan after they retire, including wraparound coverage of Medicare when they reach retirement age, with often the Medicare Part B premium paid by the health plan. This is very expensive. This obligation, unlike the pension obligation, which if Syracuse regrettably disappeared off the face of the earth tomorrow, everybody moved out, there was no more city of Syracuse, the pension obligations would be paid by the state pension fund. The city of Syracuse all by itself is on the hook for what it owes in this area, which is huge, and the same goes with every jurisdiction there is. This problem belongs directly to you. It's not guaranteed by the Constitution, but it is tangled up in union contracts and collective bargaining in many cases. So we calculated last year the per capita unfunded liabilities for all the largest cities in New York State. There's Syracuse is the highest. Now, this is largely, I'm not sure of the total reasons for this. I've got to delve into this more, but one of the reasons is clearly that Syracuse employees contribute very, very little, an unusually small amount, to their health insurance. And, of course, this has been the case for decades. This didn't begin like yesterday. And it's very hard, given the current state mandates to change this. Oh, by the way, the county also has issues. If you look here, by the way, I've got, there's the Syracuse total. Syracuse, the combined school district and municipal unfunded liability for retiree health care is $1.6 billion. People who live in Syracuse, and only the people who live in Syracuse, have promised $1.6 billion in health benefits to people who now work for them and people who are already retired, and have not set aside a dime to pay it. How's it paid? It's paid pay as you go. So Syracuse, like Buffalo, like Albany, like several other older cities, is now spending more every year on health insurance for retirees than it is for health insurance for active employees. That's not something the mayor can wave a wand and simply change. There's a big lock-in effect, largely due to the mandated rules of dealing with these things that make it very difficult to change these things overnight. But that is a huge set of handcuffs. When you're paying more for people who no longer work for you, that is you're paying for something, for a service rendered to your parents, even if my fellow grayheads in the room. You're paying for a service that was rendered to your parents. The compensation for the guy who picked up the garbage and patrolled the streets in 1972 included the promise of retiree health benefits that's being paid now, when they're much more expensive than they were in 1972. That's why you should not do that. The county, by the way, has a similar issue. Onondaga County has $700 million in unfunded pension obligations. You also have, if you live in Syracuse, of course, you have your share of that. That's $1,500 per capita, in addition to, for Syracuse residents, the $11,000 per capita of the other piece. So this is what my talk is all about. We need to deal with this. As I said, the ball's already rolling on a lot of these problems I've talked about. What can we do about them in the short run? What can we do about these rising costs in the short run in isolation? Nothing. Nothing. However, you can stop doing it, like, right away. Stop adding to this problem. And stop building a bigger problem for our children and grandchildren, which, as this cartoon depicts, is what we're now doing. In terms of resources, I'm going to leave this up. This is our website and a website off our website that has more information on pension benefits and work we've done on pension projections. And so now, in the time that's left, I'll be happy to do questions and answers.
Okay, thank you. Start right here.
You said that 401k plans were drastically unfunded. How can they be unfunded if you offer a choice of 20 funds and you put a cash match in?
If people are not putting enough in. People are under-saving. In other words, they've been... many of the plan designs are flawed. Not as a class, not as a group. There are good plans and bad plans. There's very good 401ks. I'm in one, nonprofit version of one. I'm in myself. It's very well done. The fee load is low. There's a big, great choice of funds. There are other plans that are bad. Let me give you an example of bad design. The problem with all these that everybody knows with all these funds and the defined contribution fund is many people just won't pick. In other words, you give people options. A certain number of employees won't pick. You put the paper in front of them, you say pick. They say, I don't. If they're young, they don't think they're ever going to get old. They don't pick. And in too many cases, the default plan is like a money market account. It might as well be a passbook savings account. The default choice is a bad choice. So you have to have a plan design that makes the default choice. Where people refuse to choose, the choice should be one that is a prudent one for someone in their situation and age. And are there good designs? Yes. But also, on average, people who are in defined contribution plans haven't put enough into them. Some employers don't contribute enough as their share or suspend their matches some years when they have troubles. That becomes a problem also. So that's what I meant when I said that most of them, frankly, and the statistics show this, on average, they're lousy. That doesn't mean that as a group they're a bad category or that they're a bad choice. It means that there are not enough of the good plans out there funded properly by employers and employees.
have a question about possible impact on villages of New York State. That they're kind of at the bottom of the food chain, so to speak. And what is the effect on these small political entities, population 700, 800, 1,000, 2,000, of what you're talking about here?
Well, and with regard to the pension costs, it is exactly the same, just in a smaller proportion, as it is for a city like Syracuse. If you have retiree health insurance obligations for your employees in a small village that's tiny and shrinking, somebody is not going to get what they've been promised, or somebody who's left is going to be holding a very big bag. This is based, the closest analogy to this is the big three auto companies, before they officially went bankrupt and got bailed out a couple of years ago, all had these enormous legacy costs, particularly for retiree health insurance, from times when they had employed twice as many people, all of whom were now retired and collecting health insurance, that they were still paying for, which they also had not pre-funded. They were paying for it pay-as-you-go. What they did finally was they went out into the corporate bond market, borrowed a ton of money, like billions of dollars, created a retiree medical benefits trust, or actually suggested to the union that it create one. So the UAW created a retiree benefit trust. The automakers went out, borrowed a ton of money, gave it to the union and said, here, it's your problem. Actually, a version of that is what's going to have to be part of the solution here. The state of New Hampshire has created retiree medical trust funds where you basically have an employee and or union managed trust into which the employer puts funds. But note, that becomes, it's not a liability. So in the case of a village, if you did this going forward, it would not be the village's liability. It would be the employee trust. And the village would simply have a commitment to putting money in it on a continuing basis. It's more viable to start it in mid-sized cities and on the state level, and I would hope we make some progress in that direction in the next few years. We're hoping to develop some more specific proposals in that direction.
Thank you for starting out our day so nicely. I appreciate that. One question I have, maybe this is urban legend, but let's say someone was a county legislator for 25 years and making $16,000 a year, and then they became a commissioner of some department and made $70,000 a year for 5 years. What would be their pension income based?
Your pension is based on your highest earnings, not your career earnings, so it's not urban legend. If you had a lot of years in the system at a minimal salary and then got your three highest average years at a high salary, your pension is based on the high salary. That's one of the flaws in it. One of the proposed fixes for those who would preserve the defined benefit plan, this is what Britain did, for instance, with all its public plans. They actually did it in midstream, as they simply changed them all to career earnings plans. Now, there is a lot of gaming of the system in that way, actually. And again, you, being human nature, if I was in a position to do that, I sure would do it too. If you can, I mean, that's the way it's set up. That's why it shouldn't be set up that way.
I just want to clarify. So what you're saying is that if it's frozen as of tomorrow, that's only going to impact new employees. So anybody who's currently in the system, we still have to pay out at whatever rate they are. Unlike most other employers like us, when we froze our plan, it ended. Okay, so the only thing we can do is to freeze it going forward.
Yeah, well, yes. And here's the other, this is why, now when I say you can't do anything about it, there is one thing you can do about it, and this is particularly important for anybody involved in collective bargaining. This has to really get into public awareness. If you have a group of public employees who are in this system, and you're collective bargaining with their union, the union says, okay, we know times are tough, but we just want 2% more next year. The point is to say, time out. You're already getting 2% more next year. In fact, you're getting 3.5% more next year. It's going to your pension. We don't have anything else. See, here's the key thing. This is part of employee compensation. It's a very valuable part of employee compensation. The total cost of employee compensation is not just the salary. It's the total package. The cost of the compensation package for these employees, and I'm not even including the health insurance, whose cost, as you know, in the private and public sector is skyrocketing. The cost of the compensation package for public employees due to this pension trend over the next few years is going to go up, depending on the year and our projections, 2 to 4 percentage points a year every year for the next few years. There is one thing you can do about it. You can't do anything about the pension cost. What you can do is say, there's not going to be any pay increases the next few years. The money is going to your pension. That's only fair, in my view. I mean, that really is the way of dealing with it.
You keep saying that there's no way we can do anything about the cost, but isn't something going to happen about the cost? I mean, this bomb is going to go off. I mean, there is no way that we can generate enough resources to meet these unfunded obligations. So what's, I mean, is there going to be a federal bailout? Is there?
Well, no. I mean, on the pensions, we are generating the resources, and it's costing us dearly.
Well, but we can't continue to meet that.
No, that's why we have to change going forward. Okay.
But if we just change going forward, is that going to enable us to deal with the unfunded portion that we have now?
Not by itself, no. We have to recognize, but the pension is not the main problem. The cost pressure from pensions right now is a big problem, and it's going to be a problem going forward. But when you talk about what's sustainable, what's completely unsustainable are the retiree health care costs. When you promised, again, in the city of Syracuse alone, over $1 billion, you basically, that's $1 billion in debt. You've promised $1 billion worth of something to people, and you don't. You got the $1 billion? Are you going to grow so fast? And is Syracuse got such enormous economic growth potential that it's going to easily absorb, you know, be able to cover $1 billion in promises over the next? Now, that's not constitutionally guaranteed. It is pretty much legally locked up in a collective bargaining sense, but you can't afford to pay it. Each individual city, village, town, school district, and county, in addition to the state, is going to have to deal with that on their own. It would help if the state created a legislative framework to make it easier to move the ball in the right direction, but nobody can bail that out. That can't be bailed out. That's far too, nobody's going to bail that out.
So if a city like Buffalo, as Buffalo did, either goes bankrupt or comes under state control, then does that negate all of those contracts?
Well, what has been done in Buffalo, the farthest control boards have gone, control boards have not been able to break into benefits too easily. They've tried, and they haven't succeeded. What control boards have been able to do, and what was done in Buffalo and upheld in a series of court decisions, totally on the side of the control board, is what Buffalo did was what I was urging before, is it basically froze wages. It froze wages and so-called step increases for a period of 3 years. So nobody in Buffalo got a raise, including your automatic longevity increase, for 3 years. That is what they were able to do, and they were able to order changes in contracts and cuts in other areas. But getting into the actual employee benefits, that is the territory that has not been fully exploited. Now, so far, no one, even under threat of a wage freeze, because of the other laws that exist in New York State, not even control boards have been successful in creating leverage for city officials to say to unions, look, we got to sit down and do a new deal on this health insurance. In Buffalo, some of the unions agreed to, and others said, no, we won't do it. They just refused to do it. In fact, their attitude was, you're freezing our pay, we won't talk to you. So the Buffalo teachers famously, they're finally giving it up because of the PR hit they've gotten from it. The Buffalo teacher plan was so rich, it included coverage of cosmetic surgery. And the control board, using that as an example, there's a lot of unnaturally youthful-looking 55-year-old teachers. And the control board, trying to make an example of it, highlighted that. It said, come on, you know, let's change your benefits. And they said, no. And they didn't. They've just made a concession in their first contract in a while to change that. Maybe everybody already got the surgery they wanted, but also that I think the PR effect of it over time was so great that they just didn't want it being talked about anymore.
You kind of alluded to it when you spoke about the number of people taking the benefits increasing, but what's been the effect of people living longer and the current downturn in the economy where people are taking the retirement benefits when they normally would have, you know, work more?
Well, that's a great question, and that is exactly what a big part of the problem is, because, again, this system, like Social Security, was designed in an era when people weren't living as long. We still have a system that assumes financially, really the structure of the pension system for police and fire, assumes that these poor guys are just completely worn out and have not much life ahead of them when they're 48 years old. Okay? You know what, by the way, the actuarial tables show? They live longer than the average person. Seriously. The New York City pension tables, cops live longer than the average, but they can retire after 20 years at half pay. So that is a problem, and yes, everybody's living longer, including them. And these systems have always had even earlier retirement than Social Security. So the so-called the great landmark Tier 5 reform raised the minimum retirement age back to where it had been at Tier 4, which is 62. Do you know many people in the private sector who are retiring when they're 62? If you can, you know, God bless you. But, I mean, the Social Security age is now 66 or 67 and is probably going to be closer to 70 in a few years.
If a person or a business owes more money than it's able to pay, it might go bankrupt, in which case the people who are owed the money get less than a dollar for what they are owed. What's the consequence of a city going bankrupt?
Well, to the extent that cities, and more than a few, are balance sheet insolvent right now, by the way, New York City is balance sheet insolvent to the tune of $100 billion. It's not reflected at all in its bond rating. What happens in the short term is nothing if you're just insolvent on paper. Cities can go bankrupt. In New York State, we've never let a city go bankrupt in modern history. We have them, they seek protection from the state, and they're put under financial control, as it's called, and what's basically an extended quasi-bankruptcy-like workout period. But it's not as thorough as New York City really had the closest thing to like a quasi-bankruptcy. And even that was not as far as bankruptcy might go. But, you know, bankruptcies have not been tremendously successful in fixing these structural issues elsewhere. You may have heard about Vallejo, California, a really screwed up city with really not growing, very heavy costs, had its own pension fund like a lot of places in California. Imagine that Syracuse had its own pension fund. I mean, so had a lot of problems, had a contract it couldn't afford, went into bankruptcy. It's now just come out of bankruptcy. Well, it was really expensive, first of all. Secondly, it got more concessions out of their unions, which was their compensation cost was their main problem. It didn't really fix. You wouldn't look at Vallejo and say, well, now that's a health. That place is fixed now. It's not fixed. It's just it's paying its bills again. And there are different types of bankruptcy. You may hear it about Harrisburg. I mean, there are places that go bankrupt because they have one like spectacularly bad problem that blows up, like the Harrisburg incinerator. Or in Jefferson County, Alabama, similar deal. Or Orange County, California, 20 years ago, where the county comptroller, you know, pooled all the money of all of the authorities and municipalities in the area and put them into derivatives that blew up. That was a huge, huge bankruptcy. That wasn't about their structural imbalance. You're talking about a structural imbalance bankruptcy. The problem is bankruptcy will basically ensure that, you know, the government continues to operate while bondholders are paid, more or less, and stuff is done. But it's not a fix. Bankruptcy doesn't trump politics. You need to have strong leaders committed to change, which I think you do in this region, by the way. I mean, but we don't have structures in place that can be used to bring about change sufficiently, I think.
I was going to ask if you could end on a good note. I think strong leaders committed to change is a good note, but do you have any other hopeful message?
Well, here's a hopeful message, and it's always darkest before the dawn. A lot of people complain, and local government officials understandably were very unhappy about the property tax cap, and their point understandably was, you're capping taxes, but you haven't done anything about the mandates that drive up our costs. Well, part of the theory behind this, I think, is if the pressure gets intense enough, it's going to become more obvious and imperative for the state legislature to do something about mandates. And here's why I say that. And in fact, Peter Baines, the head of the Conference of Mayors, points this out all the time. Their agenda for 100 years has included mandate relief. They've been calling for mandate relief for 100 years. And it hasn't been forthcoming. And I've been around Albany for 30 years. There absolutely, positively will be no mandate relief of any kind for local governments unless there's a massive crisis going on. And then there will be mandate relief. So unfortunately, we may need the massive crisis first, but I think that if things get bad enough, we may see some of the broad structure. It's one thing if there's one or two cities going into financial control. If things are really bad enough, I think there's a chance we can see the mandate relief we need.
We'll look forward to that. Thank you, E.J. McMahon.